Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Although worries about the state of American democracy are inherent in our political system, they seem to have reached a fever pitch in recent years. On the eve of the presidential election, two experts join me today to discuss the health of our American democratic system. Shana Guderian is a professor of political science and chair of that department in Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship. She's the co-author of Anxious Politics, Democratic Citizenship in a Threatening World. Tina Nabachi holds the Strasser Chair in the school's Department of Public Administration and International Affairs, and is also the director of the school's program for the advancement of research on conflict and collaboration. She's the co-author of Public Participation for 21st Century Democracy. Tina, Shana, thanks for making the time to talk with me.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
So I would like to end this program on a positive note. So I'm going to start with the bad stuff, and then we'll go from there. So Shana, let me direct this first question to you. What would you regard as the most concerning changes in our political system in recent years, which work against effective small d democracy?
Sure. So there's a lot, but I'm just going to focus on one thing, which is political polarization. So we have seen over the last 30 years or so, what we would call sorting along the parties, which is that people who are conservative now have sorted themselves into the Republican Party. People who are liberal have sorted themselves into the Democratic Party, and there's very little crossover anymore. And that might be okay, that kind of sorting and having the parties be clear as to what they stand for. The problem with political polarization is not only that the parties are sorted and now more far apart on their policies, it is the lining up of the social identities that people have with their political identities in ways that are, there's no more kind of cross-cutting cleavages. So what I mean by that is, it is now the case that your religion, your gender, your race, these things all kind of line up along with your partisanship in ways that they did not, say, 20, 30 years ago. And what that means is not only do you are you in a party with a group of people who are very much like you, you also see yourself as very different from people in the other party. And that, what we call affective polarization, is not only do you see yourself as different, you dislike the party more. And so that kind of polarization, that affective polarization that lines up with social identity, means that people don't want to date across party lines anymore, right? We don't see as many marriages across party lines. They don't want to live in neighborhoods as much with people who have different partisan identities as they do, because they don't see a kind of shared values in the same way as they used to. And though that kind of polarization makes it very hard to compromise, right? Because if every issue is now an issue that gets to values and it gets to your identity, those kinds of compromises now seem, on policy grounds, now seem much deeper and harder to get to.
I want to come back to an aspect of that, but let me get Tina in on this, and then we'll take the conversation from there. So Tina, the same question to you. What from your perspective is the most concerning change in our political system in recent years that works against small d democracy? Is it polarization, or do you want to talk about something different?
You know, I think Shana really articulated the polarization piece so well. I would simply add to that, that polarization is leading people to really create these attacks on democratic values, on democratic institutions, on democratic practices that have been so fundamental to American democracy. And we can see that in our big political institutions, Congress, the office of the presidency, our courts, but we're also seeing these attacks happening in our bureaucracy, right, among our civil servants. And we can see that most recently through the executive order. And I think these attacks on democratic institutions, they're really, and values are really reflecting this kind of shift that's happening. Perhaps, I don't know which way the causality is. I don't know if it's polarization is leading to this or this is leading to polarization, but these different kinds of value sets that are emerging. And so for me, one of my big concerns is not just that we have political cleavages around party or around identity or around religion, But I think we're starting to see the beginnings of regime cleavage, where people have fundamentally different views of what government and governance ought to be. And that tension is concerning to me. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges we're facing.
So let me follow up with you first and then swing back around to Shana's point and ask a question about that. But you were talking about that this polarization is fueling attacks on the institutions themselves. So is part of what you're getting at that in the mindset then of someone, it's that, look, if my cause is just and my cause is to advance the interests of my party, then it's worth tearing something down in order to do that. It's okay to do that. Is that kind of what you're getting at, Tina?
I think that's certainly part of it, but I would also say that the cause is driving people to believe that the institutions were not good to begin with. So that lack of trust that has really been kind of fomented in the American public is really problematic. And so we hear calls around kind of the corruption that's embedded in our institutions, this lack of trust or this lack of sense of legitimacy. And that is both kind of propelling these attacks and also kind of, I think, eroding the foundations of those institutions.
Yeah, and that directly leads, Shana, to the thing I wanted to ask you about, which is that given what Tina's talking about then and what you mentioned, I think if you have a political leader like President Trump, I don't want to suggest that these problems are all on him, but if you have a leader like that and then you have the reactions against him that you have, it's like throwing gasoline on a fire, because we're already primed with the polarization, and then you take that and put it in and you've really got something problematic. Is that a fair way to think about it, you think?
Yeah, I think you've gotten to what is really dangerous about the rhetoric that only tries to appeal to one's own party, right? So one strategy that politicians could have is to try and build coalitions. We have not seen that from this president, right? His coalition in 2016 is still the same coalition now, and he hasn't reached across either with policy or with rhetoric, really, to people outside of his voters. And so that kind of cements this idea that you're either a Trump voter or you're not. And I think that makes it really hard to then think about, well, how could I work with my neighbor who has a different political leaning than I do on a community project? Or how can we do something in our state that might have nothing to do with national politics, but then, you know, you think of that person as so different than you, when that's probably not the case. But it's hard to, I think, overcome that when we're kind of separated in this rhetoric across these different camps. And so I think that's problematic. I will also say there's a kind of related problem, which is it also makes people who aren't already interested in politics want to opt out, right? So there's no real sense of, right, that politics can be for you and if you are someone who isn't deeply partisan. And I think that also keeps out a portion of the public who doesn't like politics to begin with.
And also, it strikes me, watching Joe Biden's campaign, and Tina, maybe you can comment on this based on what Shana just said, is that he seems to be really torn, kind of straddling two sides. On the one hand, he says, you know, I want to be president for everyone. I want to be and help and respond to those who do not vote for me. On the other hand, once you get outside of Joe Biden and you listen to the Democratic messaging from other leaders, it's pretty red meat. I mean, it's pretty directed toward the faithful. And so we're in kind of a binary function here, if you will.
I think that's right. And I think that binary function is not just Democrat, Republican, but it's also within the parties, right? So you have some who on the Democratic side would like to be more centrist in their policymaking and others who are being more progressive, who are leaning further to the left. And I think you're seeing similar divides in the Republican Party. To pick up on something that Shana mentioned just a moment ago, I think that this kind of new or stronger, more kind of vicious, if you will, polarization that's happening is not just turning people off to politics. It's I think this is going to have long lasting impacts in terms of who runs for office, not just at the federal or state level, but even at our local level, where the politics have just gotten so ugly and so partisan. This is going to be a real challenge for our local democracy. And that's where democracy happens, right, is at the local level. So I'm concerned a little bit about that going forward.
It's going to make it harder for the Mayor Walsh's and the County Executive McMahon's to emerge, the new ones, right. Sure.
And the city councils and the school boards.
Yeah.
All of those.
Yeah, school boards. So let me stick with you, Tina, and this really follows directly on what you just said, because I think there is a notion, or maybe it's a hope among some activists and citizens, that, you know, once President Trump departs the scene, later this year or 4 years from now, whichever one it is, that somehow we'll return to a better normal, that, you know, to put it this way, at least American politics will be great again. So it sounds like from what the two of you are saying, though, that it's not that simple at all. So can you comment, Tina, on that? I mean, how deep is this problem going forward?
You know, for me, I think that's a little bit unclear. I do see a silver linings to this. I do see some possibilities for hope, but I also have concerns that the damage is deep and it will take a while to repair. I think it's deep in a number of ways. We've seen politics divide families in the United States. It's gotten so ugly that families are divided. It's not just your local parties or your state parties where these challenges are emerging. So those wounds, those divides between American public are going to take, I think, a while to heal. And I also think there's going to need to be a lot of repair work done to rebuild people's trust in institutions, to roll back and reverse some of the challenges that have been posed to courts, to Congress, to our administrative apparatus, and to make sure that those actions that really weakened those institutions don't trickle down and start happening at the state level and our local levels.
It seems like some of them already have, based on what you've said and some of the things that I've seen. Shana, do you want to comment on that at all briefly?
I generally think of this kind of the Trumpian kind of rhetoric is a symptom rather than a cause of polarization. And so I don't think that even whenever he's out of office, things go back to this kind of norm of kind of civic discourse, or that, you know, we're getting back to like the height of social capital, if you kind of think of a Putnam kind of world where people join their local organizations and that helps build trust. But that also gives us a potential model, right? If we think about building local communities back and getting people working together on projects that may not be clearly political, where they can see the ties between each other, I think there is that capacity in the public. It's just about thinking about how you get people, you know, and this is more challenging in the time of the pandemic when we're supposed to be separate, but how we can use tools of technology, or we can use our kind of organizations on the ground to try and get people working together in ways that seem less harsh, right? And that seem like you can make these connections and start building civic capacity on the ground in the local communities.
Well, that kind of constructive, more hopeful analysis is what I want to shift to in the second part of our conversation, but we'll take a break for now. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Syracuse University professors Shana Guderian and Tina Nabachi, and we're discussing the state of health of the American democracy. Okay, so I wanted to leave plenty of time for good stuff, and I want to end on a happy note. So let's think about silver linings now. Tina, I think you actually used that phrase before, but what are the silver linings in our recent political life that you see?
Absolutely. I think as a consequence of the polarization of people feeling estranged from one another and estranged from government, we've really started to see this kind of community-oriented action where people are coming together around a whole host of issues. So we are seeing greater, not just awareness of, but greater willingness to publicly discuss and, you know, speak truth to power on a host of issues, mm-hmm. from from racial inequities to wealth inequalities, distribution of wealth, to sexual assault, and a whole other host of policy issues like climate change. And for me, that's really exciting, because I think that what were once just clusters of people often working in isolation, those clusters have really grown and really become connected with one another and elevated these issues to national dialogue in a way that we haven't seen before.
Shana, your thoughts on that?
Sure. I think I would point to a lot of the same things Tina did. One is the kind of the rise of these protest movements that we've seen, the massive number of people participating in protests on policies that they care about. I mean, that is not a bad sign for democracy, right? That is a sign that people feel empowered and they can think about how they use their voices to participate in politics. And from those movements, we've also seen a lot of new types of people running for government, mm-hmm. right? So we saw in 2018, this wave of teachers running for office. We've seen lots of women and candidates of color who felt, again, that the system wasn't working for them. And so instead of just giving up and being cynical, they are now part of the conversation. And I think that's all to the good to get broader and deeper participation.
You know, can I jump in on there?
Yes, absolutely, Tina.
I think this is such a great point, Shana, because it's not just that new and different people are running for office, but new and different people are joining movements that were once kind of connected to particular groups. And so we're seeing suburban moms come out on the front lines for the Black Lives Matter movement. We are seeing veterans come out and speak out about all sorts of issues. And so this kind of cross group fertilization that's happening around these issues is, I think, a very positive sign for democracy in America.
Well, do you think that, and either one of you wants to jump in on this, do you think that the polarization and the depth of division maybe is necessary for some of these things that you're citing as good things? Or is it getting in the way? It seems like maybe one way to think about this is the polarization and the negative feelings are kind of the birth pangs of maybe of some of these more positive things. I don't know. Maybe they are separable. What do you think about it?
Possibly. I think we might go back to the times when we didn't have such polarized political parties. And this is the time when we also see lots of kind of social capital, right? So I don't know that they're necessarily, so social capital meaning lots of people joining groups, lots of people working together. And I don't know that you need to have polarization to have this kind of level of engagement. I do think what one of the reasons, as Tina's pointed out, that we see such engagement now is a lack of trust in our institutions, right? And that the idea that the institutions themselves are not representative and they aren't actually responsive either. And so it's possible that what we're seeing now is just a reaction to the idea that the institutions themselves are failing rather than the polarization itself.
So let's think about ways we might change the system to make it better from a small d democracy perspective. And first, let me start with the practical and the doable, and then we'll get to the more pie in the sky stuff. But Tina, if you could make one practical and politically doable change in our political system right now to make it more democratic with a small d, what would it be?
That's a really tough one, Grant. I would say I would focus.
But you've written a book on it. You should have no problem.
Well, then I was about to go there. I would say we need to focus at the local level and create opportunities for public participation, and not in that conventional way of 3 minutes at the microphone, but true, meaningful, authentic opportunities for people to come together, discuss challenging questions that are facing them at their local level, and figure out ways to respond to that. So I would encourage all of our local political leaders to really seize this moment, to seize this opportunity to have tough conversations around inequities in our communities, about how we respond to the COVID-19 pandemic when our coffers are dry, to create spaces where people can come together, disagree without being disagreeable, and make suggestions and solutions for moving forward. And I think that really best happens at the local level.
Shana, if you could make one doable and practical change, what would it be?
Oh, that's a hard one. I think we should have a conversation about the ways in which we have national institutions that overweight some voters and underweight others. So the Senate, for instance, right, which gives extreme weight for rural states and kind of gives less representation to places like California, which have lots of our, right? So we have many institutions like that, the Senate, the Electoral College. We want to think about, are those still kinds of institutions that benefit a large, diverse and public in ways that may overweight some people in the country?
Well, I want to give you both a chance to also wave a magic wand and change things. But before I do that, there's something that I haven't heard from either of you that I'm just realizing now, and it's striking, and I wanted to ask you about it. Neither of you have mentioned the media or social media in any of this, either as a problem or a silver lining or something you'd want to change. So, Tina, why is that, do you think? Is there something important that needs to be said about the media here?
Sure. Well, I think the media, social media technology, this is really a double-edged sword. And 10 years ago, so many Democratic activists, Democratic reformers were saying that, oh, social media, this is going to shore up our democracies. It's going to give new voice to new people. And I would say at best, you know, this is, this is a double-edged sword. It does give voice to new people, but it also helps divide people. I think that the technology issues are a really big one, not just in terms of social media, but also in terms of artificial intelligence, the growing surveillance state. I think these are all threats to democracy, not just in the United States, but globally. And there needs to be some real concerted and honest attention to these things sooner rather than later.
Mm. And Shana, you have written on the media. I'm so struck by that it was absent for both of you.
Right. So I think there's one thing we haven't talked about, right, in the media, which is also local media and how important the death of local newspapers has been in terms of people knowing about their local communities. And it is actually part of the reason that we have this nationalization of politics, meaning that, and that does feed into polarization, meaning people will focus less on their local issues, they focus more on the national conversation. And that's partially because so many local newspapers have folded. People have no choice but to look at state and national newspapers and national media, which again, keeps them away from their local issues. So I do think the lack of local media does feed into polarization. I don't think it's a cause of it, but if we could wave a magic wand, we could have foundations that are propping up local newspapers and trying, right? Journalism is at a critical juncture right now. And if we could help kind of bring more people into print media, I think that would actually be good for local communities in many ways.
Would it be practical to, since we're moving more into pie in the sky now, would it be practical to have some sort of national infrastructure of support of the media if we're going to be thinking about other infrastructure funding? Is it maybe time to think about a more British model of a public media system? Where could we go?
Sure. I mean, like you said, there are models in other places where there's more government support for free media, right? So not propaganda media, right? We'd want to see independent media, but that was funded by taxpayers. I think that is a really nice model that we certainly do not have robustly here, and we could have a model like that. It would need to have a lot of kind of backstop to make sure that there isn't this kind of effect of having it become propaganda for people in power, for sure.
So we've got just a couple minutes left, but I do want to give each of you the chance to be, the genie. Maybe I'm mixing the metaphor here. You know, except you only are able to grant one wish, but you're granting your own wish. But Tina, let's take the practical and the doable off the table. And if you could change anything about the American political system to make it more effectively democratic, what would it be? But you only do one thing. You got to take one change.
I would love to see some reforms that open up the possibility for people truly to run and campaign for office. I think running for office now at the local level, let alone state or federal level, has become such a distant, unattainable goal for so many people. And so campaign finance reform is a little bit simplistic, but I would want to do major reforms so that more people can legitimately, truly run for office with a chance to actually be elected.
And I imagine too, I'm going to give you a second one, sorry. But I imagine too, given what you said earlier, you'd be supportive of some kind of multi-billion dollar infrastructure project for local civic participation and local civic engagement. I mean, if we're going to spend trillions of dollars on the COVID response, maybe we should throw a couple billion, which would be peanuts compared to that, into our civic life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Building a participation infrastructure, a civic infrastructure where people can have meaningful engagement around policy issues is going to be key to sustaining us, especially as, you know, the number of issues we face grow, from poverty and access to education to climate change. We're really going to need to be able to engage people so we can have attitudinal, behavioral, and policy change.
So Shana, you'll close it out in under a minute. What is your one wish that the genie is going to grant you to change the system?
An affirmative right to vote. So a lot of our time has been spent in the last several years thinking about how to make it easier for some people to vote and how to make it harder for other people to vote. And we've seen that in this election, and we had judiciaries getting involved in that. We need a national constitutional amendment to have an affirmative right to vote.
And so that would eliminate some of these suppression efforts that you're alluding to.
That's right.
Okay. Well, on that happy note, we will close. That was Shana Guderian and Tina Nabachi from Syracuse University. I want you to remember that Election Day is Tuesday, November 3rd. And Tina, Shana, thanks so much for talking with me. And I want to wish you and your families good health.
Thanks. You too.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.